Cece is surrounded by whiteness, but Cece herself grew up very much in blackness. Mm-hmm. And that was important to me to showcase because I didn't want to make a story about a black ballerina that was palatable for the white ballet world right now.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Nicole Cuffee, author of the novel Dances. It's a fictional account of the first Black prima ballerina with the New York City Ballet. A tale that in some ways mirrors Nicole's love affair with writing when it comes to commitment and dedication despite the long odds.
When I used to tell people that I wanted to be a writer, they would say, okay, but what are you going to do to make money? Or what's your real job going to be? I remember when I was a creative writing major in undergraduate school, I studied abroad in Italy, and people would ask me, you know, what's your major? And I would say creative writing, and people would literally laugh in my face.
A Brooklyn native, Nicole says her parents were always supportive of her artistic goals, even when other people weren't. How that grace emboldened her decision to pursue writing at all costs, even when she tried to get a real job. Plus, while the craft of her work always begins with research, sometimes physical, and the reason she doesn't think of herself as a Black writer and resists the label African American literature. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. So Nicole, when did you know that you were a writer?
Very, very early on. I've probably been writing for as long as I could hold a pen. If you ask my mom, she'll tell you that the first book I ever wrote was called The Queen of Jamaica. And I took a bunch of photographs and just wrote a story that sort of narrated what was happening in those photographs. But I've always been super interested in storytelling in general. My parents had this really, really big library in the house that I spent my early childhood in. And I would go in and I would raid their library and I would read as much as I could. And I think I really credit that love of reading with my love of storytelling, which translates into my love of writing. So as early as I knew what being a writer was, I knew I was one.
So knowing that you were a writer and claiming that at such an early age, how did that carry you throughout your life?
That was always just kind of in the back of my mind. I knew that I was going to write in some capacity. What took a little bit more time was figuring out what kind of writer I was going to be. Mm-hmm. I was always interested in fiction, but you know, there's always the question of if you're an artist of any kind, how are you going to support yourself? And so for me, I think that that was the part that took me a little bit longer to figure out. I knew that I was going to be writing no matter what. It feels weird to me if I don't write, and it kind of always has. That was never really a question. It was just a matter of how I was going to support myself while doing my art. For a while, I thought I might be a travel writer, and my dream was to work for National Geographic and to travel the world and write about these different cultures and maybe nature as well. I thought for a while I might want to be a linguist, and then I took one linguistics class, and that was the end of that dream. And then I thought maybe I'd want to be a teacher. So I thought maybe I would like teaching elementary school because I love little kids. And I actually did go through. I got the New York City Teaching Fellowship and was right on the brink of getting into a school and working that way. But at the very last minute, I decided that that really was not a good idea for me because I knew that if I went that route, my day job would be all consuming and I wouldn't have enough energy left to dedicate to writing. And then for a while, I had jobs that I really didn't like. And then eventually I got into being at the university level. That's what I'm doing now. And I think this is what I'm supposed to be doing. So it took me a while to get here, but teaching college students is something that I love. I have a passion for it. I get to talk about writing all day long. And I love being around college students. They're so full of fresh ideas and so passionate about the things that they're passionate about, if that makes sense.
So then teaching at the college level means that you have advanced college yourself. So did you go to an MFA program or through a PhD doctoral program?
I went to an MFA program. So I eventually landed on creative writing as a major in undergrad. And I eventually got into an MFA program in New York and graduated as an MFA with a specialty in fiction.
Okay. So realizing that linguistics wasn't for you, that like teaching
little snot-nosed kids, K through 12 wasn't for you. And then going to grad school and figuring that out, how were you writing? What were you writing during that time?
So during that time, I was still writing short stories. So I actually, it's kind of funny, I actually started out as more of a short story writer slash an essayist. So all through high school, I went to a really, really small private school. So everybody knew everybody. And I was kind of known for writing really good essays in high school. And then when I got to college, I started writing more fiction and I really got into the form of the short story. The thing was, is that when I was in college, I was a creative writing major with a focus in fiction. And when you are trying to figure out what kind of writer you're going to be, it really probably should align with what kind of person you are. Mm. And I'm the kind of person who does not do much without a lot of extensive research and planning beforehand. So it really makes no sense for me to try to write a story without planning it out beforehand. And once I started doing that, once I started creating detailed outlines and planning my stories before I began writing, I realized that I was actually more of a novelist than a short story writer. And so in grad school, I really got to explore that a lot more. I got into literary fiction, which is my lane, and I started experimenting more with longer forms of writing. And I had much more success doing that once I sort of developed an art of the detailed outline before beginning to write.
So for someone who realized that, hey, I'm a novelist, your first publication is a short story for Atlas of the Body.
Yeah.
So can we talk about that? Make it make sense?
Yeah. So I do still write short stories. It's just they come to me like once in a blue moon. It's not novels. I'll write a novel like once a year, but a short story, I'll get one of those out like once every couple years. So Atlas of the Body, I guess you could call it a short story. It's a chapbook. So it's a long short story, let's say. That was a bit of an anomaly because I actually did write Atlas of the Body with no plan. I knew that I liked anatomy. I knew that Black Lawrence Press was looking for chapbook submissions. I think the deadline was in like a day. And so I just sat down and wrote Atlas of the Body in a day. I edited it the next day and then I just submit it. And again, normally this is not how I work. Normally I would have at least a couple people take a look at it. I would take a little break and then I would go back and edit it some more. Right. But this time I was just like, you know, what do I have to lose? Mm-hmm. So I just sent it out. And it, as it turned out, they liked it, which was great. Yes.
Yeah, like you won the prize, the contest, the publication. All right. So then if that's the story for Black Lawrence Press, what has been the journey with your novel Dances? Because one, I thought I was about to talk to a full on bunhead ballerina today. Right. And then but hearing you say that, you know, you do intense research and study and outline and planning for your novels, I now understand how you like descended into the world of classical ballet to pull this story together. So what has been the journey with Dances, the writing and the publication part of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I wouldn't call myself a bunhead, but if I were not a writer, I would be a dancer. So I do have a background in dance. I was not a professional ever because that is like similarly to writing, a career that you have to completely immerse yourself into. Like you cannot do anything else unless at least until you're established in that kind of career. So writing was my calling, but if it hadn't been, then dance is my other love.
We are the same.
Perfect. Yeah. So you understand then. Yeah. I love dance. I'm a classicist when it comes to most forms of art. And dance is no exception. So I love classical ballet. I go to the ballet all the time. I hang out with dancers all the time. And I still dance myself. I take classes still. I do not perform because I am not a performer. I just stage fright. I don't like all those eyes on me, but I do it because it feels good in my body and because I just truly love the art form. So I did do a lot of intensive research for dances, but I also do have a little bit of experience about what dance feels like in the body. And I know that there are lots of sections in dances where I get really into the physical act of dance and really discuss like the body, and that I do know what that feels like. Like I know what this character is feeling when she's doing these steps and doing these combinations. But dances really kind of came to me as a lot of my book ideas do while I was taking a bath. A nice long bath is part of my sort of nightly self-care ritual. And this was a while ago. This was back, I want to say in 2015. And I was kind of thinking to myself that I just kind of had this craving to read a book about ballet, but a book about ballet that I hadn't encountered before, because many books about ballet are about dancers backstabbing each other or having, you know, these advanced eating disorders. And I just didn't want that kind of book because that isn't the whole truth about ballet. It's actually a very skewed vision of the ballet world. So I wanted a book of fiction about ballet that was a little bit more honest and less sensational, maybe. Mm. And I also wanted a book about a Black ballerina. And in fiction, those didn't exist. And so, you know, following the old Toni Morrison quote, I knew that if I couldn't find this book to read, I was going to have to write it. Now, this was in probably like April or May of 2015. And this date is important because originally what I wanted to write was I wanted to write about the first Black dancer or the first Black ballerina to be promoted to the role of ballerina at the American Ballet Theater. Right now in June of 2015,
Missy Copeland where this is going. became the first Black ballerina.
at the American Ballet Theater. And listen, the book takes place at the New York City Ballet. It's not really the New York City Ballet, right? That's a company that exists, but then there's the version of the company that's in my book, which is completely fictional. And I could have done that with the American Ballet Theater as well, but I thought that the promotion of Misty Copeland was big enough as a world event that it would be distracting if I still set my character in that particular company, even if it's a completely fictional version of that company. Mm-hmm. So I tossed the idea for a little while. I was like, I can't write this book now because it's too close to what's happening. It was probably like a year before I was like, well, Nicole, just put it at another ballet company. Like it doesn't have to be there. And so that's when I began writing. And my writing process begins with research. So I started consuming anything that has to do with ballet. I was consuming it. I was going to the ballet much more frequently at the time. I was still living in New York City. So I would just hop over to the Kennedy Center at any given opportunity and go and see the ballet as frequently as I possibly could. I resumed taking classes just to remember what ballet felt like in the body. And I started reading ballet memoirs and ballet biographies, watching documentaries, basically any kind of media that I could get my hands on, I was consuming as part of the research process. And then out of that, sort of, I start to sketch together characters. So who did I want to talk about? And how did they exist in this fictional world that I was building? And that's really where it began.
Okay, so this is 2016-ish. When did you finish the draft? And how was it when you went on agents, querying, submission, all that process?
I probably finished sometime in early 2017. And then I took a break before I went back and revised. So after that break, I went through a major revision and I started querying and I got all rejections that first round, which is, you know, normal. So I went back and edited again and I put it through another round of queries and I got rejections again. But this time I got a couple of agents who are saying, hey, this is not for me right now, but here are some changes that I think you could make and talk to me once that's done. So that was encouraging. So I didn't really have time to go through another major revision the way that I wanted to after that second round of querying. At the time, I was in a bit of a flux. This was about 2018 now. So I was moving to the DC area, which is where I'm at now. I had just gotten my job with the University of Maryland. And I was also going through some major life changes. I was going through this major breakup and I was writing another book. So I just kind of put this on the back burner for now. And in the back of my mind, I think I'd kind of had in my head that I needed to get this book queried again because it kind of felt like the right time for this story to be out there. But it just was really difficult for me to find the time to get back to it and go through the revision process the way that I wanted to.
What made you know that it was the right time for dances to go to market and go back through that process after now years and two rounds of rejections with the same manuscript?
Mm-hmm. So it started with Misty Copeland's promotion, but I would say within the past 5 years, something brilliant and beautiful has been happening to the classical and neoclassical ballet world, where we're having more and more conversations about people of color in ballet, specifically women of color in ballet, because the history of women of color in ballet and the history of men of color in ballet is slightly different, where women have been much more slowly accepted as classical and beautiful on the stage. There's been a more intense conversation about inclusivity in ballet and inclusivity and diversity kind of across the board, talking about different gender identities in the ballet world, different sexual orientations in the ballet world and how it's represented on stage, women of color dancing in classical and neoclassical roles. All of these conversations have been amping up and being insisted upon in ways that have been very different. And so I thought that my book might be kind of contributing or part of this larger conversation. And so that was kind of what was sort of in the back of my mind, like this might be the time for me to, if anyone wants to read this book, now would be when people might want to read it. But I didn't have time. And then the pandemic hit. So a couple of years later, pandemic hits, all of a sudden I'm home all the time. Like I'm barely leaving my house. And as an introvert, this was heaven for me. I mean, you know, I thrived. I was great. But it also meant that I had so much more time. So I was like, this is a good time for me to go back and completely revise this book. And that's what I did. I went back. It went a very, like the most extensive revision that it had been in up to that point. And then I queried again. And this time I got interest.
So dances is very intense on ballet, like especially in those opening chapters, like it's the steps, you're in the world, you're in the class, you're in the studio. And it wasn't foreign to me because the French, the words, the structure, I knew it. I mean, I was reading the words and I was like, oh, this is, I get this combination, I could do this combination or whatever. But I think that could read foreign for people who don't know dance. So what was it like going on submission with this book that is very entrenched in ballet until it takes a turn? And what was some of the feedback that you got from your publisher and your editors and things like that?
So when I was writing, I really tried to strike a balance between ballet language and sort of language that a non-dancer would understand or be able to visualize in some way. And I was really careful that I didn't want to translate too much. And the reason for that is because it's in first person singular. So this character would not be translating that way. Mm-hmm. And also because we live in the digital age, if you want to know what a fouetté looks like, you can look it up and, or you don't have to, you can just know that that means that she's doing something ballet-y. And so what I found is that when I did get an agent, my agent does have a background in dance. So she was familiar with the language, but when other people in the agency read it, who did not have a background in dance, they still felt like they understood what they were supposed to be seeing. And that's generally been sort of the feedback that I've gotten from people who've had their hands on this so far, is that people who have a background in dance, obviously this is very recognizable and very familiar, but the people who don't have a background in dance maybe can't see everything, but they saw enough and it also sparked their curiosity, which is great for me to hear because that was also part of my motivation in not over-translating these ballet terms and these steps, is I wanted people to be curious about ballet and to hopefully maybe spark more interest in the ballet, particularly in classical and neoclassical ballet.
Awesome. So do you have your book near you so that you can read a little something from it?
I do.
Yay. Nicole Cuffey's Dances follows 24-year-old Celine Cece Cordell in her ascent from soloist to principal at the New York City Ballet. A rise that is doubted by teachers and family, envied by friends and colleagues, and supported by one fellow artist from afar. As Cece grapples with her historic place in the dance world, she must determine who she is and what she wants, personally and professionally. Here's Nicole.
I'll read a little bit from a scene where Cece is rehearsing the ballet, The Sleeping Beauty. The music is both sweet and triumphant, the grand wedding pas de deux. Aurora is awake, alive, enamored. Desiree is alight. The wedding pas de deux contains echoes of the Rose Adagio with the four suitors, lots of extensions and balancing on point. He reaches for me. I turn my back to Kaz, to the mirrors, my audience. Develop a front, swivel into attitude derriere, port-a-bras, and arabesque. Sweat trickles in between my shoulder blades. Jasper is himself misty. There is a small wrinkle between his eyebrows. I'm frustrating him, I think. The pain in my ankle goes suddenly sharp, and I have to come down from point. I suck my teeth in frustration. Kaz calls for us to stop. He has insisted on rehearsing us this time, and I am relieved at the break from Cecilia. Get out of your head, my beauty, and into Aurora's, he says. Again, and. We drift away from each other, and then, as though suddenly realizing we're apart and no longer able to bear it, we turn. Desiree runs toward me, drops to one knee, arms reaching. I run to him, arabesque penché, a kiss, our sweaty faces a centimeter apart. We linger there a half beat too long. Jasper squeezing my waist, trying to help me find my center of gravity. Again, we separate and come together again, a force we're helpless to resist. Attitude derriere, promenade and a half. Again, my back is to an audience of Kaz and my own reflection. I nearly lose my balance again, but I fight it, teeth gritted.
Thank you. So coming to your work and reading the story, the more I read, the more and more and more I fell in love with Cece. And I love that it was in first person singular, so that we're always in her head. We're learning her motivations, what makes her think, what makes her tick. And so like, by the end of it, I was like, I love this girl. She's young, but she knows who she is, and she has always known who she is. Did you draw that part of her story from like your own life and knowing that you were a writer from such a very young age?
No, that's a lovely idea though. Maybe I did unconsciously. No, I think I drew it more from just a sense of Cece having to know that this is the career path for her. I mean, that's one of the things I think that's so fascinating about the professional ballet world is that in order to achieve success, in order to have the kind of life as an artist that you envision as a dancer, you have to know very early on that that's what you want to do. And you have to make a commitment before most people are ready to make commitments of any kind. I'm talking like when you're in the single digit age still, you need to know that this is what you want to do. And you have to have a lot of support, from taking the dance classes to the very expensive supplies that you're going to need, to the support you're going to need to dedicate the amount of time that it takes to hone this craft. You have to know really early on. So Cece is very young at 24, but at the same time, she's grown up completely differently than a 24-year-old who's not in a career like this.
What strikes me about this conversation with you, and I totally think that you should have a conversation, and I hope it's on your tour schedule, with Lisa Williamson Rosenberg, who was on the show earlier this year, because she was a professional ballerina before she became an author. And so when we talked a lot about her background in ballet, but also about how a lot of her first manuscripts that she wrote were about Black ballerinas, and they, like, people didn't get it. Like, why, how is she Black? How is she biracial or this or that? Her exact phrase was, it's too many things, right? And so I feel like your book is the kind of book that she had been writing that was rejected. And now your book has like filled that space and that void and that gap. And so it makes me think about Cece's struggle in the book of seeing herself in a place where she knows she belongs, she wants to be there, and yet having to prove her worthiness and her value. Was that intentional, especially because she's a brown-skinned Black ballerina and Missy Copeland is a Black ballerina, but the shade difference makes a difference. And so can you talk more about how you're processing all of that? I know that was a whole lot.
Yeah, so the shade of my character was quite intentional. She needed to be brown because I do think that there is still some colorism at play in the ballet world regarding female dancers of color. The ballet world as it is right now is growing, but it has been slow to sort of create more spaces for brown dancers. So darker skinned dancers of color or female dancers of color. So darker skinned ballerinas of color. And so I wanted to ensure that this dancer was brown skinned, that she had kinky 4C hair, that she didn't grow up in a white space. She grew up in Bed-Stuy, which is where I'm from. you know, that was really important to me because, you know, I talk a lot about how Cece is surrounded by whiteness, but Cece herself grew up very much in blackness. Mm-hmm. And that was important to me to showcase because I didn't want to make a story about a black ballerina that was palatable for the white ballet world right now. And I think that's kind of what's been happening. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that it's taken so long for this story to get out there because I just know I'm not the only one. I know I'm not the only one who was hungry for this story. I know I'm not the only one to have written this story or story like it because there are lots of little black ballerinas who are only just now seeing people who look like them on the stage in featured roles or in solos or as principal dancers. And, you know, Misty Copeland does a lot of work to support young dancers of color and to go into communities that otherwise might not be exposed to ballet and introducing them to ballet. And I think that's amazing. I would love to see more of that work done, but I would also love to see, I'm always big about the arts and how they intersect with each other and how they're in conversation with each other. So just as the ballet world is starting to catch up, I think the literary world has also been having much different and much more evolved conversations about who is represented and by whom in literature and what we consider literary canon and what we mm-hmm. don't. And I think that's fantastic. But I think there's tons of work still to be done in terms of making sure that there's a diversity of stories and not in a way that is meant to teach white people or meant to be palatable to white people, but that is simply the story of people of color in whatever presentation we happen to be in.
And you talk about being embedded in blackness, even though you're surrounded by whiteness, for your mm-hmm. character, for the dance world, for the publishing world. And so it makes me wonder, in talking about Cece specifically, because she has a kind of discomfort, it seems to me, about how much she stands out in her surroundings and a bit of imposter syndrome a little bit. About who she is and where she is and what she's doing. And is her hair reverting? And is she sweating too much? And is she looking too muscular? And is she eating too much? And all of those things that a dancer would normally worry about. But then there's the added level of race and the color of her skin. And, you know, that's very much, I think, akin to you can be the only one in this space, or you can be the only black book in this space as an author, or you can be the only this. In giving that to Cece and then thinking about your journey and writing, how do you seek, I guess, to balance the pressure with the expectation and the craft?
I think for me, I focus mainly on the craft. So when I think of myself as a writer, I think of myself as a writer. I don't think of myself as a Black writer. At the same time, I am very aware that I am seen as a Black writer. And so I think there is this sort of this balance between understanding myself as an artist and being really interested in honing my art and continuing to grow as an artist, but also understanding that my Blackness has a place and is in many ways central to my art. I mean, I write almost entirely about Black characters. My protagonists are almost always Black, especially in my novels. So I write about the Black experience because I live the Black experience. And I think, you know, part of me is always a little bit resistant to the idea of my work being considered African-American fiction, because the implication is that African-American fiction is somehow separate from other types of fiction. Which is in a way dehumanizing. Blackness is an inherent part of the American tapestry. We can't talk about America as we know it as the country that it is today without talking about Blackness, even if some people might want to. We just can't really do it, not honestly. And I think that's very true in the art world as well. I kind of keep saying this over and over again, but I think it can be said generally of the art world is that it has been slow in catching up to the times, especially if we're talking about mediums such as dance, such as literature, and such as the visual arts. So paint, photography, things like that have also been very slow to get with the times. I see this changing. I see the tide sort of shifting, and I'm thrilled about that, but it's slow. So our sort of collective as an American culture understanding of what a Black artist is, I still think is slightly dehumanizing and slightly othering. So for me, I don't know. It's almost like I don't feel like I alone can fight that phenomenon. So I do recognize that, you know, no matter how I think of myself, there's a way that I'm going to be seen publicly. And I think that kind of speaks to that sense of, you know, the double identity that there's me as I understand myself, but then there's Black woman as the outside understands me. And I kind of have to understand both of those perceptions of myself. And I think that's absolutely true when it comes to my art as well. I have to understand myself as an artist first, because that's I think where my growth comes from. That's where my focus on craft comes from. But I also have to understand myself as a Black artist and sort of be aware of what that means in terms of my social identity and where my art fits into a society.
There's another artist in the book, her brother, Paul. Mm-hmm. And I love how the cover of Dances evokes his work. Why was it important for you to have this brother and sister who are 10 years apart be almost like twins and both be artists and born to parents who are like, I don't understand what the hell y'all are doing?
Cece needed someone to support her. And her brother, I think, was it. So I had a couple of sources of inspiration for this. One was the story of my mother's brother. And one was the idea of a muse as a symbiotic relationship where we both kind of feed off of each other. Mm-hmm. So my mother had a brother who was much older than her. He was actually 20 years older than her. And he died when she was 8 of an overdose. And hearing her talk about him is always so, as heart-wrenching as it is, it's fascinating to me because she was very young when she lost him. But she has this very sort of visceral memory of him. I haven't seen pictures of him, but the way she talks about him gives me such a clear image of him. And I think it's so sweet, but also so interesting as far as human experience is concerned. So I wanted to explore this in my own way. Paul is not my mother's brother, for the record. They're different people. But I was really interested. And I also feel very connected to this uncle that I could not have met. I have his Bible. I discovered this uncle's records. I discovered Jimi Hendrix and Richie Havens. And that's how I sort of developed this interest. So I have this, I feel like, connection to this uncle, even though I've never met him, as a muse of sorts, that we have this connection through our interest in a form of art. And that was really what I was trying to do in the creation of Paul is, you know, he's a different kind of artist. He's a different kind of personality, but they have this connection as sort of mutual inspiration. She inspires Paul because she's often the subject of his artwork. But Paul also inspires her because of his struggle. And what she does with that sort of propels her through her discipline and through her craft. Mm-hmm. So that's what I was trying to do with that character and that relationship. And then the parents just kind of act as some tension. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people might read Cece's mom as completely unsupportive, which I could see why they would. But I don't think she is quite completely unsupportive. She's loving her children the best way she knows how. And that's all I'll say about that, because I don't want to spoil anything else. But, you know, she's doing her best. And, you know, so is Dad. Dad is also doing his best.
Talking about the family, you have a line from the dad where he says something like, you didn't run to me, you didn't love me enough, something like that. And he's really heartbroken about mm-hmm. what he expects to get from his daughter, I guess, especially. But what strikes me about the mother is that I didn't feel that she was unsupportive. I felt like she was a practical Black mother. Because when you tell a practical Black mother of a certain age from a certain generation, I'm going to be a dancer. I'm going to be a writer. I'm going to be a painter. I'm going to be a musician. That was like, you can be a music teacher. You can be a dance teacher. You need to get a job. Right. Absolutely. And so I don't feel like her mother was unsupportive. I feel like she was doing the best she knew to do to, as you say, protect her children. And I wonder, did you encounter any of that? If not from your mother, just from family members? Because I think when you tell people that you work in the arts and you are like a living, breathing artist, whether you write, dance, sing, whatever, it's like you're a unicorn. Like people don't get it. So like, so what do you do all day?
Yeah. 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 So my parents, bless them, are, you know, Black. They grew up in the Bronx and in Brooklyn. My dad comes from a very traditional Caribbean family. He was an attorney for most of my life and is now a judge. And my mom is a psychologist. So they have these very sort of professional track careers. And they never batted an eye when they had this sort of floozy artist daughter. Never batted an eye. I've always been extremely supportive. And, you know, I think if I had told them that I wanted to join the circus, my mom would have bought me an elephant and like geared up. You know, I have the best, most supportive parents. So it's kind of funny that the parents in this book are kind of almost polar opposite of how my parents show up for me. But that being said, I do think that this sort of mentality of I protect my children by grounding them, even if I have to do it harshly, is very much a part of the Black community and Black culture that I was very much aware of. And I will say I always had my parents' support in what I wanted to do professionally, but I had no one else's. So when I used to tell people that I wanted to be a writer, they would say, what are you going to do to make money? Or what's your real job going to be? I remember when I was a creative writing major in undergraduate school, I went and studied abroad in Italy. And people would ask me, you know, what's your major? And I would say creative writing. And people would literally laugh in my face, like literally, like not even. So I also am very familiar with what it feels like to have people think that you can't do the thing that you really want to do, or that you can't do it in a way that is going to support you. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you're going to follow the path of a career like this, where you don't know when it's going to be enough to support you, or if it ever will, you kind of have to develop a bit of a strong backbone, not only because you're going to experience quite a bit of rejection until you kind of get your grounding and hone your craft enough, or even after you've honed your craft enough, you're still going to experience a lot of rejection, but you also are going to have a lot of people who either don't get it and are trying to get it, but just kind of can't wrap their minds around it, or who think you're ridiculous and think that this is, you know, you're going to be 52 living in your mom's basement, still trying to start up that band. You know, a lot of people are going to think that about you too.
Yeah.
And I understand why people think that way. It is unlikely that you are going to be super successful in an artistic career, but you just have to know how to do what's best for yourself. You do have to figure out how to support yourself until you get to where you're trying to go. And you just have to sort of develop this unwavering faith in, if not your art itself, because we all go through imposter syndrome. We all think that everything we do is terrible at some point. I know for me, it's just kind of part of my creative process. I'll start writing. I'll think I'm the best writer in the world. And then about three pages in, I'm like, why do I even do this? I mean, who's going to want to read this drivel? Like, what am I doing? And that's just kind of part of it. That's natural. But what doesn't waver is my faith in my commitment to my craft. I know that I'm a writer. Whether I'm a good writer or a bad writer changes depending on the day. But whether I'm a writer does not change. So I think that I was very, very lucky to have such stable support from my parents from so early on. But I also think that I was lucky to encounter people who laughed in my face when I told them what I wanted to do, because that helped me to develop that strength and that stability, and knowing that, look, whether I suck or whether I don't suck, this is what I am. I'm a writer.
So with that said, Nicole, we've got the short fiction chapbook. You've got your full length novel. You mentioned that you had written another book before you came back to dances. What's next?
So I'm working on a couple things right now. One is a book that I'm currently editing, and the other is a book that I'm currently writing. So the book that I'm writing right now is about music. It's about blues and folk, the folk revival scene of the 60s. So that's kind of got a lot of my attention right now.
All right. I want to switch to a speed round and a game before I let you go for what's soon to be the afternoon. So What is your favorite book?
Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison.
Who is your favorite author?
Toni Morrison.
What is your favorite ballet?
Sleeping Beauty.
If you could set a piece of work on the ballet stage, what would it be?
I like the idea of telling Black folk stories on the classical, neoclassical stage. So I think I would do something like May and the Hag. I think that could be so interesting to create an American tradition that focuses on Black folk tales and maybe even Native American stories and put them on the stage.
What is your favorite song?
Today, I'm going to say it's going to be Fall of Confusion by The Temptations. It's been on my mind lately.
And who is your favorite composer?
Tchaikovsky, hands down.
What do you think is the best book to movie adaptation?
The first thing that pops in my head is Lord of the Rings.
If money were no option, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
If money were no object, let's see, I would do exactly what I'm doing. I might just teach fewer classes. I had a little bit more time. I would get a house in the DC area, which is where I live. But then I would also get a couple more houses in other parts of the country and maybe internationally. And I would travel a lot more. I'd go out of the country at least two or three times a year.
Name three things on your bucket list.
Go to a few more Asian countries or a few Asian countries I've never been to, the Asian continent. I would open a charity that is focused on reducing student loan debt for people of color.
Yes.
And as someone with a lot of student loan debt.
Same.
And I would write a children's book.
I could see a young CC on a picture book, just saying. What brings you joy?
Experiences. So hanging out with my dog, hanging out with my husband. I have a 3-month-old and just looking at him brings me joy. Hanging out with friends, trying new foods, traveling, seeing new places, learning about different cultures, learning different languages, things like that.
And what brings you peace?
Peace for me is sunlight and not too much to do. So sunlight and space and time.
I'm here for that. All right. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics.
Ooh.
And classic is however you define it.
Okay.
Name one book you wished you would have written.
Ooh. Okay. I wish that I could have written We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson. It's such a strange and beautiful book.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Oh, Richard Wright's Native Son. I would change the ending. Not necessarily what happens, but I would change the emotional impact just because I'm looking at this book from a modern eye through the lens of someone who's living in, what do we call this era? The post-Black Lives Matter era? Or do we think that we're still in Black Lives Matter era? I think we've moved on to something else almost.
I have no idea.
We're in a state of emergency, really, when it comes to the treatment of Black and brown bodies in this country, and really not even just this country. I mean, I think people around the world, particularly in European countries, love to look at the United States and kind of shake their heads in disapproval as though they don't have these same problems. But the fact of the matter is that they absolutely do.
It's just different.
And they're not talking about it the same way that we are in the United States, even though we're still failing to do something substantial about it. We're having conversations that a lot of the world is not having yet. So I would love to sort of revisit the themes and the end of Native Son through this lens.
Okay. And so now my messy question, name a book that you think is overrated or overtaught for the professor in you and why?
I am really not a fan of Shakespeare. And I think that anyone who knows me well has probably heard me go on my Shakespeare rant at one point or another.
I'm here for a
rant. But what I will say,
give us the rant.
is that Shakespeare, while I do acknowledge and give him his accolades for his contributions to the English language and how it's evolved over time, and we're still using phrases that are derived from or directly come from Shakespeare's work, I think he has got to be one of the most overrated writers in the history of writers. He was a plagiarist. And not only was he a plagiarist, he was a blatant plagiarist. He wrote in the plays that he was plagiarizing into his plays in many occasions. And yet he is lauded as one of the greatest English writers of all time. I think it's malarkey. He is very overrated, according to me.
According to Nicole. I love it. I'm here for it. I love a good rant. Okay. My final question for you today, Nicole. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
I hope I'm remembered as a writer who was serious about her art and as a person who was serious about how she impacted other people in her personal life. That's what I would hope.
Thank you so much, Nicole. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Nicole Cuffey for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Nicole's debut novel, Dances. And if you're not following Nicole, check her out on the socials. She's at Nicole the Cuffey on Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you liked this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Nicole about a pivotal moment in the book where Cece must decide whether to put her personal life first and how that reflects on today's polarizing political climate. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Victoria Christopher Murray, author of Pride, a Seven Deadly Sins novel.
I self-published Temptation, and we did something I called guerrilla marketing, where we gave cases of books to our friends who wanted to sell. And it was near Christmas, and those people were selling. And I think I went to 17 cities in 6 months. We sold 9,000 copies.
In 1997,
we came out in October. And we had done 5,000 copies by December. We had to order more. We ordered another 2,500, then another 2,500.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.